Welcome to session 7 of the International Relations and European Integration class. It's nice to have you back. So today I will talk about the economics of conflict, so to speak. So how are conflict activities interlinked then with economic interests and so on? And first, I will simply look at the costs of war, but also at the costs of armament. And for this, I will talk about the guns versus butter dilemma that plays a big role in international relations and thinking. The second part is then much more optimistic, and it examines and evaluates the liberal notion that economic interdependence makes the world more peaceful. And in the last session, I look at two potential qualifications of this. One of them is economic sanctions, and the second one is then the resource curse literature. Let's first say something about this guns versus butter dilemma. So this has been addressed in a very cynical way by Joseph Goebbels, who, after all, was a very cynical person by definition. We can do without butter, but despite all our love of peace, not without arms. One cannot shoot with butter, but with guns. President Eisenhower then also took up the notion, and he then rather saw this much more critically. As you know, he was a general during World War II and then a Republican president in the United States. So he believes that this is a real dilemma there, and that every investment in arms is basically a waste and cannot be used to address then the real world problems. And Maggie Thatcher, to use her again, became the Iron Lady when she complained that the Soviets put guns over butter, but we put almost everything over guns. So let's look at the guns-butter dilemma from a more analytical point. So if you have a completely autarkic state, then everything that you can produce is within the production frontier. And what you have on the production frontier are just efficient allocations. So it's then the question, the dilemma, whether you move, for instance, from this point down to this point, if you devote much more to consumptive goods by the population, or whether you then rather favor and put more emphasis then on the production of guns. If you do not use the resources efficiently, then you move towards the origin down there, and you have, for instance, this point here. The question now raised by Eisenhower and others is on whether military spending is a wise investment or not. So whether military investment, as any other public investment, has a positive impact on economic growth. So this has been examined in many different studies. So what we have here then is, for instance, a study by Mike Ward and colleagues, and they believe that this is the case. So you see here a clear significant impact in the simulation that they have calculated for this particular study. But as they qualify further on, there is then this impact depends on how indebted a particular country is. So these considerations have to be taken into account. And this you also see in this evaluation here. Eisenman and colleagues, they look on whether countries are threatened militarily or not. And if you take just military expenditures in general, and this you see on the top of the table, the impact is negative, but only starts to be significantly negative in equation 3. But if you interact this variable with the presence of a military threat, only then is the military spending economically profitable, and it increases economic growth. So there are certain background conditions. It's not always the case that military spending is a waste, but it's also not always the case that military spending increases economic growth. Okay, let's move then to the second topic. So what are the economic costs of war? So here you also have to differentiate whether a country is autarkic or not. In an autarkic country, what you then see is that just production facilities and so on are destroyed, and you have a move of the production frontier to the interior. Simultaneously, when you have a non-autarkic country, so a country which engages in trade, then you also have the benefits of economic specialization, and you reach a higher level. This is signified here by point C versus point B, and through a conflict, trade is destroyed, so you also have these economic costs to consider. So on the one hand, you have here that facilities, production facilities are destroyed, production is interruption, but you also have then the effect that certain trade is moved to other partners in such a conflict. So you have additional costs to consider for non-autarkic countries. Okay, so these are all the factors that you have here that should be considered. So generally, war is costly, and economic agents should have an interest in avoiding wars. Once the war is over, you have some effects that have been described by Menker Olsen, and already mentioned this once in this lecture. And this is the puzzling phenomenon that some of the countries that are particularly affected by a war and who lost a war, that they grow more quickly after the war. But this is not the case for all war economies in general. So let's look first from a purely descriptive perspective at some of the estimation of war costs. One of the first statements was made by John Maynard Keynes when he looked at how the world looked like before the Great War and afterwards. And he was advocating the benefits of globalization, of economic interdependence, and he describes here in this statement just how the British life of the upper class has changed. So, but obviously the benefits of trade, they also translate to other parts of the population, as you will hear in further sessions in this class. A more econometric estimation has been made by Joseph Stiglitz and Linda Pilms. Stiglitz is a Nobel Prize winner, and he published a book on the costs of the Iraq War. The first estimates by the administration by Bush II were quite modest, some billions. But the estimates by these two authors are much, much larger. And what you have to consider are not only the direct costs for the soldiers, for the military equipment, and so on, but also something which is called then the opportunity costs. And opportunity costs are, for instance, the foregone trade. Because you engage in a war, you cannot then exchange goods. This is simply lost, and in all these calculations, this has to be included. And this is what is done in this particular study. There is also a contribution by our colleague Anke Höffler in this regard. So she has looked and she on the costs of war, what this means absolutely, but also as a percentage of worldwide GDP. And this, she distinguishes here between different sorts of violence. First, you have political violence, which he calls collective violence. Then you have interpersonal violence, homicides, and so on. And what you also have then is intimate partner assaults, and when you discipline children. And here you have then, for instance, the psychological consequences and costs that society has to bear as a consequence of this form of violence. Note that all this is closely linked together. War begets war, as the old saying goes. So as a consequence of collective violence, you have an increased likelihood that a massive number of intimate partners are assaulted, and so on. When you take all these costs together, and this is the one of the first attempts by Anke, now together with Jim Fearon, just to calculate these costs, you see the astounding number of 11% of world GDP. Obviously, it can easily be debated on whether this is lower or whether it's even larger, but there is a lot of social waste linked to violence and also to warfare, although percentage-wise, the costs are relatively small, but this was also written for a period where the number of wars and the number of large wars was relatively small. This is just for illustration what we mean with this Phoenix factor. So the phenomenon that the losers of war after the war might grow more quickly, and this was described by Organsky and Kugler, who is misspelled here once, Kugler. They looked at the aftermath of the Civil War in the United States, but looked also at comparison of different states over time. So losers grow more quickly. And in the perspective of Manker Olson, this has to do with the destruction of networks of vested interests, of special interest groups in these losing societies. Okay, here I have for the mini break more normative question. I mean, should Germany produce and or export arms? What are the security risk of arms exports? And as you might know from listening the news or reading newspapers, military expenditures are growing again and have reached a new height in the last year, a trend which was probably continued despite the coronavirus crisis. Okay, thank you. Hello again. Here is the second part of session 7, and I will look at commercial liberalism and from two perspectives. The main hypothesis is that trade or other forms of economic integration, that they reduce the likelihood of war. And the second hypothesis is just the reverse. It looks on whether or not then war reduces economic interactions at all. Commercial liberalism as the democratic peace, as you know from session 6, is part of the Kantian peace, and it has its origin in the writings of philosophers of the Enlightenment, particularly Montesquieu, who coined the phrase of the esprit de commerce, something which was taken up then by Kant in his pamphlet Perpetual Peace. There he speaks of the spirit of commerce, which cannot exist side by side with war, according to this translation. Frédéric Bastiat, a French politician and journalist, wrote very nicely, and this is the essence of this hypothesis, if goods don't cross borders, soldiers will. There were other writers of the 19th century, like Cobden and so on. Obviously, in other general theoretical strands, you see completely opposite perspective. So take, for instance, Marxism. Take the theory of imperialism as it was formulated by Hilferding, Rosa Luxemburg, but also by Vladimir Ilyich Lenin. They just expect that increased trade, increased imperialism results in class war, will result in a global war. It's just the opposite expectation. And realism just doesn't care, basically, about trade. Everything that matters is just polarity, if you are a structural realist. Again, as you have seen it for the democratic peace, politicians just love the notions of commercial liberalism, that there is a nexus going from free trade to peace. A nice statement is by a former prime minister of Singapore. The alternative to free trade is not just poverty, it is war. And today, where you are in a confrontation of the United States and China, people recall the justification for a deal, the trade deal between the United States and China made by Bill Clinton towards the end of his second tour. So towards the House of Representatives, he said that this is a a step toward peace in the world. So the expectation is that an increased integration of China in the world economy would China make a less repressive state. When you think about Hong Kong and so on, you can see that here the hypothesis has really an empirical challenge to deal with. Okay, there is also a phrase by Chancellor Angela Merkel that you could interpret in this particular manner. Before Norman Angell is one of the originators of this particular thesis, and what he built was just an opportunity cost argument. So war, armed confrontations, they destroy the possibility to trade, to do business with others, and this is a cost you have to consider, and it's generally called then an opportunity cost. And exactly this kind of argument has been invoked by John O'Neill and Bruce Russert in their various writings, but it also plays a big role, as you have seen in the pamphlet of Norman Angell. More sophisticatedly, it was put into a trade policy making model by Solomon Polacek of the University of Binghamton. And his expectation is, ceteris paribus expectation, so you keep everything else constant. The greater the amount of trade, the higher the price of conflict, and the less the amount of conflict that is demanded. Some people like Eric Gartsky try to challenge this, but Solomon Polacek established that this argument by Gartsky and colleagues is not really worthwhile. Okay, the hypothesis is so influential that it has also found the pop version that was established by Thomas Friedman, who is a journalist and editorialist at the New York Times, and he called this the Golden Arches theory of conflict prevention. And he stated in 1996, no two countries with a McDonald's franchise have ever gone to war with one another. The problem that he had then later on, because he wrote an entire book based on this hypothesis, was then the Kosovo war, when the United States and its allies, basically NATO, dropped a bomb on Belgrade, and Belgrade had more than seven branches of McDonald's, but Tom Friedman did not take this as an instant that contradicts his theoretical expectation, but he wrote, this is rather an exception that in the end only proves how powerful is the rule, simply because he stated that people wanted to have badly their McDonald's reopened in Belgrade. So this should not be taken too seriously, but obviously the hypothesis attached to commercial liberalism is something that should be examined empirically. And it was first rejected by my co-author Catherine Barbieri, who published an article in the Journal of Peace Research in 1996, where she claims that high levels of economic interdependence, a variable that she called saliency, and which measures the interactions of trade shares, that one side has with the other side, increases the risk of conflict. And when you look at the figure out of this article, but it's also has been then been republished in a book that she published in 2002 with the title of The Great Illusion, Norman Angell is in the background. In this figure, you see here that the higher the trade shades are, the higher is the risk of conflict. And this is based on models where she looked at militarized interstate disputes from 1870, just before World War II. Obviously, Bruce Rossett, who was then still the editor of the Journal of Conflict Resolution, did not like this contradiction to the Kantian peace program that much. So in the journal he was editing, an article was published by Xiang and co-authors, and they first replicated the model by Barbieri, and then added power variables, basically resources of the two sides, which are lagged. This you see through the T minus one here on the slide. If you include these variables, then the positive sign is just reversed. Methodologically, this is a problem of omitted variable bias. So for a convincing model, you need to include these models, and through these robustness checks, you see that your hypothesis is falsified. Just to explain briefly what omitted variable bias means. So you can think about in Venn diagrams. So you have this one hypothesis, economic interdependence, and this is the risk of war, and you explain so much of the variance and in positive terms. But when you include then the other variables, then this variance is eaten up. And for this particular subset that you have up here of this relationship, then the relationship might be a negative one. This study and most other studies establish that indeed trade has this effect. Some French economists came up with an interesting study where they compare bilateral openness, how much interactions you have in a diet of states, or then how open a country is in general. And they expect opposite effects. For bilateral trade, you have these opportunity costs, which are important here, and you see a reduced likelihood that you experience a militarized interstate dispute. But if you then look how countries are engaged into the world economy, then you see a positive impact. And they explain this largely through the possibilities to substitute trade partners. So you can do business with other states if you are in a conflict with a former business partners. Nevertheless, commercial liberalism is one important theoretical strand, and this finding by Philippe Martin from Sciences Po in Paris and his colleagues has been contested. Okay, some of this has also been applied to civil wars, and the expectation here is that before a liberalization, there is an increased risk because you have increased conflicts within states over how open the economy should be. Machi and Massoud find evidence for this in an article published in the Journal of Conflict Resolution. Let me move then to the second hypothesis. Does war destroy trade? Cassie Barbieri, this time together with Jack Levy. Jack Levy is the guy that claimed the democratic peace is bordering on an empirical law from its, if you judge its theoretical status. And Barbieri and Levy came up with the notion that, okay, we would not expect that trade, that war destroys trade. And one of the examples that they used was trade between Germany and France throughout the second half of the 19th century. And you see here the war 150 years ago destroyed trade, but basically only for the war year. Then it was quickly rebounding again. So they see that there was no permanent damage here. And they believe that this anomaly just is another blow to the Kantian hope that all these economic factors are important for the decision to use political violence or not. Anderton and Carter, two economists, re-examined this claim, and they came up with a second problem for this study. They believed that they used the wrong sample. So if you, for instance, include other periods of time, also for the same diet, France and Germany, and look at the impact of World War I, then see a much more long-lasting effect. But you also observe quite often that trade has been declining before the war occurs, because the confrontation between two states already started earlier, and it would be very unwise from a business person to invest then in this particular country. So some of these effects might also have to do, the effects that Barbieri and Levy found might also have to do with the anticipatory effect that appears here in the data when you look at trade between the US and Germany in this period of time during the interwar years. And it didn't go to the level before the war during the 1920s. I was a little bit dissatisfied with this particular literature, so what I did then was, together with a former student of the University of Konstanz, with Vera Tröger, who is now professor of political science at the University of Hamburg. So we looked at stock market rallies and examined on how different wars impact then stock markets. We also included the Bosnian Civil War, not only the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, or the Gulf conflict. And what we could establish that there is indeed a war rally effect observable for the United States, that the Dow Jones Industrial Index increases as a reaction to increased conflict, and it decreases if cooperation increases. And the measure for this is that we used so-called event data. This is just then what is measured on the daily level, and we regressed indicators derived from this event data then on the three stock market indices besides the Dow Jones Industrial Index. We also have the French stock market index and the Financial Times stock market exchange, where we do not find such effects. And this finding is just something which has also been established in other contexts. When a war starts, then stock markets go up and people invest more in stocks. What you also see here, and this is a study by Massimo Guidolin and Eliana LaFerrara. So Eliana and her co-authors, they looked at the civil war in Angola, and There was rebel leader Jonas Savimbi and his troops, they controlled several diamond mines. And what they show is that the stock market price for the mines situated, of the companies who did business in Angola, decreased after the death of Jonas Savimbi. And so the death of Jonas Savimbi signaled basically the end of the civil war in this country, but this was bad for the diamond companies in this country. So war events have also then distributive effects. First, we have the war rally, that at least in the beginning of a conflict, when certain confrontations lead to increased stock market prices, prices for certain assets. But this is also the case then for specific firms, as you see here in the study by Guidolin and La Ferrara. And my question for the mini break and the tutorials is, how can you explain this? Is this pure cynicism on behalf of the investors? The second question, do these gains persist over time? And you can ask yourself, which firms profit from political violence and why? And you can think in similar terms when you think about how financial markets react to the COVID crisis. Who are the winners, who are the losers of this crisis in the economy? This is the last part of session 7, and I will talk about economic sanctions and the resource curse. And both of them are some sort of qualifications of commercial liberalism. So let me move first to economic sanctions, what they are, how they can be defined. So economic sanctions are just a means with which one state or one actor can obtain the concession from the other side. And this follows then much the logic of a deterrence situation or a compellence situation, to use the second term that Schelling has used in his writing. A strategic interaction, and you, for instance, want that the other side stops with its human rights violations. The instruments that you can use here are economic ones. So you can, for instance, then stop trade, you can stop or curtail, at least to some extent, financial relations with the other states. Or, since some decades, increasingly, you target specific representatives of the other political regime. Think about the sanctions of the European Union against Belarus. So crucial members of the entourage of President Lukashenko are then sanctioned. The intention of these targeted sanctions is that you do not want to have large side effects towards the population. Crucial here is the writing, as I mentioned, of Thomas Schelling. And then, as this is comparable to a deterrent situation, what matters here is whether your commitment to your sanction threat or to your imposed sanction is credible, whether the sanction will still be imposed some months down the line if there is increased domestic opposition against this measure. Economic sanctions have a bad name. So this starts with the study of economic sanctions in the 1960s. Again, one of the initial studies came by Johann Galtung, who analyzed the sanctions against apartheid Rhodesia, which is now after the liberation Zimbabwe. And these were multilateral sanctions, and the general expectation was that they were not effective, they did not reach their goals. This article was written in the 1960s, so political change in Rhodesia only happened towards the end of the 1970s. Okay, but Galtung also concluded was that sanctions may even contribute to exactly the opposite of what they hoped for. So what he stressed here were the side effects of sanctions. And what you typically also find in the literature is how much the population is suffering, leading to the question whether this can be justified, all these costs that have been amassed over time. So are such economic means then really creating the costs that lead to the desired changes? Let's just look at how sanctions are imposed today. The problem of a lot of the research is, or at least the early research, is that they only looked at imposed sanctions. And as in a deterrent situation, when you are already in a crisis, then probably your deterrent effect did not materialize. So what you would see in an ideal world, that at least the threat that you might impose a sanction should work. What you see here also is, and this is an analysis that I conducted with Patrick Weber, and these articles have just been published by different journal, Conflict Management and Peace Science and the European Economic Review, is that the United States is still the most active sender of sanctions. Nowadays followed by the European Union and then the United Nation. But you also see here that a lot of the sanctions are multilateral, so the EU teams up with the United States, or then you have a joint sanction where the measures of the European Union and the United States go beyond what the UN mandates. So this is the fourth possibility that appears here in the figure on the top right. And then you have unilateral sanctions, almost 200 cases, threats and imposed sanctions by the United States in this period. So you see here that the United States are a global actor in this realm. It even sanctioned Ireland in the beginning of the 2000s because Ireland wanted to join the World Crime Tribunal. The sanctions of the United States, which were minimal, did not reach this goal, so there was a question of effectiveness. The EU is also a global actor. After 2015, there were also sanctions against Venezuela, so Latin America was also more frequently sanctioned. And what you see for the UN, sanctions mainly in countries where the interests of the Security Council member is relatively small, so poorer states, sometimes very, very hard cases like Iran or North Korea. What you have here, obviously, is a regime, and such international policies are called also regimes. Such regimes do not always work perfectly, so you do not necessarily have the right targets be targeted. Some countries escape sanctions, and then you see other cases which are sanctions for certain misdeeds, for which other countries have been not sanctioned at all or much more lightly. So we call this under sanctions or over sanctions. Perhaps more interestingly are under sanctions. So when you take the European Union as a center, it should have, in the time period studied, sanctioned Russia for four more years. Sanctions were too light against Belarus. For the United Nations, the sanctions against Sudan were too light, and India, the United States did not sanction India at all, although India's behavior at a certain point of time would have justified the imposition of sanctions. What is about sanction success? What we observe here is that sanctions work much better than we sometimes think. So there are two measures for sanction success. One of them comes from the TICE data set. And there we have an overall success rate for threats or then imposed sanctions of around 50%. What we also observe here is that the US is much more successful with its threats, relatively speaking, than the EU. And this has obviously to do with the fact that the US can also threaten much more credibly with the usage of military means, is this context. So once the US has to impose sanctions, this is already a failed case. And for the EU, then the imposed sanctions are quite impressive. If you have the different score, this is the so-called Hufbauer, Schott and Elliott score, then you also see this difference. The EU has reached in almost 50% of the cases the goals with its sanctions. So sanctions are much more useful tool than popular writing would suggest. Obviously, there are some failures, but these failures might not be that grave. So COP costs of disrupting trade have an impact on the economy, and they are an effective foreign policy tool. Let's move to the second and last part of this session, the resource curse. States who have natural resources have been discovered to grow less than one would expect. And this phenomenon has been called also the Dutch disease because it was attributed to the situation of the Netherlands in the 1970s, or the paradox of plenty, that these countries who are rich in resources, they have disproportionately low growth rates. And this empirical relationship found its expression in a study, then an empirical study by Sachs and Warner, which was published in the European Economic Review in 2001. And you see this on the graph on the right. So you have here on the x-axis exports of natural resources in percent of GDP in 1970, and then you have the real GDP growth per capita, and you see an almost perfect negative correlation here. How can this be explained? At least initially, this was explained through the appreciation of the gulden in comparison to the German mark. Why is this the case? Because a lot of investment was going to the resource sector in the Netherlands after the discovery of the North Sea oil. This led to an increase also in the wage levels in the other export sectors of the Dutch economy, made these industries less competitive, and in consequence, growth rates were declining. Natural resources are not always a blessing. What does now the empirical literature say about countries which have then natural resources on whether they experience conflict or not? Some of these resource exporters are stable or relatively stable. Other ones are highly unstable. And think about the difference between Norway and Venezuela. So some other factors might play a role, and some people have then especially stressed the role of political institutions. The first study adapting more or less the same research design as Sachsen-Warner did in their earlier study was a study by Paul Collier and Anke Höffler, who examined whether or not primary commodity exports have an impact on the risk of civil war onsets. And what they said is that there should be a curvilinear relationship, meaning that this effect is particularly strong for countries here in the middle, and it declines then for countries like Saudi Arabia, where the economy is more or less completely defined through this one export sector. Okay, they find support for that. Simultaneously, they were attacking then in this article the grievance literature, which argues that here the grievance of particular parts of the society leads then the frustration these people have because they are not part of the economic and political game, leads then to civil wars, and they rejected this. And this is measured through fractionalization, the fractionalization variable included here. Since the publication of this article, Paul Collier has become an academic entrepreneur and has published several textbooks. The first one, The Bottom Billion, I still think is the best one of those, but you might pick them up at the airport or the railway station once you fly again or take the train. This theory, this hypothesis has then been refined, and exporters of diamonds and oils have been attributed to different sorts of conflict. So if you take, for instance, oil, if a country, an oil exporting country, has largely offshore deposits, then the risk of civil war is perhaps not that large. There might be an increased risk of a coup d'etat, because the coup d'etat would also link you to the possession of the oil resources and the rents, the oil bonanza that is generated through that. With diamonds, then you have similar effects. So it matters then also how large the deposits are, and obviously the more you can gain, the harder you fight for this particular possession. Here you see some of these relationships that have been established in the literature here. What is important here, the arguments become much more refined over time. We have quite strong evidence, and this is largely due to Michael Ross, that there is something like an oil curse. People have moved away from the general resource curse in this domain, but institutions play a role, and what we have established in the different studies based on Luong and Weintal is that ownership arrangements at the micro level play a big role. So it's important on who possesses a particular resource, And here, especially international ownership leads to increased conflict, increased government repression, because the general population does not really see much from this investment by international owners, who might ship all the profits, all the rents directly to their home countries. The last thing with which I will bother you here is then the international dimension of the oil curse. There are not so many contributions here, but the Colgan contribution is the outstanding one, and he made an argument that petrodollars make a difference, but only if the leaders of such regime pursue then a revolutionary agenda. So you see this first in figure one, what the expectations are for this combination of petrol income and then a revolutionary agenda. You see it, it's then considered to be very high. And this you see in the increased risk that such states engage into militarized interstate disputes. If you have a non-petro states with a revolutionary agenda, there is a 46% increase, but if you take a petro state, it's almost a 250% increase. The one thing you should now think about is, are you convinced by this argumentation, and whether or not there is some sort of exogenous factor lurking here that explains whether or not certain regimes are pursuing revolutionary agendas. Okay, this is it for today. I hope you enjoy this, and please go and visit the tutorials. Thank you.